You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters Live. Welcome to the podcast that showcases the big ideas, the innovations, and the visionaries in the food industry. Digging deep is what we do here at Table Talk, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stephen Gates. I'm a food science writer, I'm a TV presenter, and I'm a gastronaut. Now, in this Valentine's Day edition... In this Valentine's Day edition, we're exploring the dark sensory delights of chocolate. But if you're expecting a fantastical Wonka-esque history of delight, you may be surprised, because its 5,000-year history is transformative, but it's complex and often brutal. In many ways, it has shaped our world, and not always for the better. It was more valuable than gold in the early Americas, then was a driver of the slave trade and an object of endless fascination for Victorian inventors, but even today, there are persistent accusations of modern slavery. The story of chocolate is a tale of secrets, desire, and exploitation, often touted as an aphrodisiac, at least by the people who sell it. Its chemistry is fascinating. Cocoa has the most complex flavour profile of any food ever discovered. There are at least 600 compounds, alcohols, carboxylic acids, aldehydes, ketones, esters, pyrazines, that have all been identified as odoractive components, and that's the bit that I really love. It's also a fascinating lens through which to view the development of the food industry. We're going to explore the secrets lurking behind chocolate, uncovering the most astonishing chocolate creations of all time, and the answer to the question, could we start growing cocoa plants here in the UK? Enough from me. Our guide is the fantastic food historian and writer Emma Kay, author of the brilliant book, The Dark History of Chocolate. Welcome, Emma.
Hello, and thanks for the plug.
That's what we're here for. it's such a treat to have you here. Now, first of all, Emma, what is your own personal relationship with chocolate? I'm sort of imagining that you're sitting there in a sort of chocolate-lined room.
Gosh, I wish. Wouldn't that be nice? unless it was really hot, of course. But I guess chocolate has always been around. I mean, it's a kind of a child of the kind of 70s and 80s. Not really the sort of chocolate that I would eat today, but I always remember a lot of Quality Street hanging around. The thing is, I think probably like most people, our relationship sort of starts from a really early age. So we grow up with it. It's constantly thrown at us throughout the calendar year. Like you mentioned, Valentine's Day, chocolate Easter eggs. Now Christmas has become all about chocolate and hot chocolate and, you know, and gifts. And when you want to say sorry, it's a bar of chocolate. You visit someone in the hospital, you give them chocolate. But, you know, it is something that is part of most people's lives. Although I was quite surprised when I wrote the book how many people sort of approached me and said, well, I don't really like chocolate, you know, and I thought, that's really strange. I always assumed it was one of those things that everyone enjoyed, but it's not to everyone's taste. No, not at all.
It's really strange, isn't it? Yeah. And also, the one thing that I find really strange about chocolate is the magical nature of the word, especially when you're talking to kids. You know, you can be talking about anything, they'll be bored out of their tiny skulls. Mention the word chocolate, they come alive. And it's just really annoying. It's like, oh, come on, be interested in the rest of the stuff as well. But you are also a historian, aren't you? You're not just a chocolate obsessive. You've got form here.
I mean, I'm a qualified historian. I worked in museums. I had a big career as a historian. And then I sort of switched into food historian mode about 10 years ago. And I've been writing books for 10 years almost, which is amazing. But I also trained kind of very loosely over a long period of time as a sous chef as well. So I've always had that real interest in food, and food was a big part of my childhood as well. So I try and combine the two. It's perfect for me, really.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're exactly the right person to be talking to about exactly this. Now, let's start off. Now, cocoa is a weird thing. Now, can you describe for me what a cocoa tree looks like?
It has like pods. It has pods, and within those pods, you have the beans, and then it's those beans that are then dried down.
But for me, it's that alien look of it's a tree with pods popping out of its trunk. It just seems so wrong. It's like, I mean, it is Willy Wonka-esque, isn't it? You know, they're often all different colours, bright orange and purple, and they're growing out of the trunk of the tree. It's like no other tree I've ever seen. I mean, it's almost like it started as a weird magical thing.
It's funny that you should say, do you know what? I've not actually thought about that before. The actual physicality of the tree has never really occurred to me. But now you've said that, yes, you've got me thinking. It's funny.
It's almost as though something as fantastical as chocolate needs to come from something as bizarre as a cocoa tree. Yeah. Okay. All right. So let's delve into the bit that you really are interested in. So it's the history. So lots of food histories often start sort of post-Columbian exchange. So around the 1500s, when ingredients arrived in Europe, as though that's when they began to take their sort of their form on Earth.
Yeah.
But if we start there, we're missing thousands of years of food history, aren't we? So
yeah.
Can you go back to the start? And tell us, what do we know about chocolate and how it was first used and cultivated?
Yeah, I mean, I guess everyone starts from the 1500s because, you know, that's when all the writing about it started, and that's when more people became literate. But yes, obviously, there's a huge amount of history before then. Early pre-Hispanic communities did leave some evidence of their relationship with chocolate. So through drawings on the wall, through and it's in pottery, you know, there is evidence, and some of it was written down as well in sort of strange script. But I think the first kind of community that you can look at who experimented with chocolate were the Olmecs. I mean, we're talking sort of 4,000 years ago.
Yeah.
And they are a community. They're the ones that sort of created these massive, great big stone heads. But they are the first that experimented with it.
And how was chocolate consumed? What sort of form did it take?
They probably used it more as a ceremonial rite than the Aztecs and the Mayans that came after them. You know, it was very, very sacred to them, and they used it in sacrifices and all sorts.
As I do at home, actually. I always use it in my sacrifices at home.
Do you? Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. I've never tried that. I must.
You've got to get into it.
But I think the Olmecs, really, it was more sacrificial than actually consuming it. It was more kind of spiritual and symbolic to them. And it was equally so to the Mayans and the Aztecs. But they also start to drink it quite heavily. And they drink it during sacrifices. They drink it for pleasure. They drink it to offer up to the gods. They also gave it to people before they were sacrificed as a kind of, here you go. I hope you're going to feel good about this. This is going to make it better for you.
Yeah, so it's not all bad. So it sounds like it was a drink with great value. Was it sort of drunk by the masses? Was it drunk normally, or was it a reserved for special occasions, do you think?
Are you talking about the Aztecs and the Mayans, or generally?
Oh, Aztecs and Mayans.
It was drunk by everyone, but I mean, it would have been something that the hierarchy would have had control over. I mean, not anyone, I don't think, would have been able to go out and just get their own beans or whatever. There would have been some system involved. And of course, I think that the Aztecs found it quite difficult to grow in some areas.
Yeah.
And so they traded it with the Mayans. So things like, you know, we know that there's records of things like one turkey being equal to 100 cacao beans and that sort of thing.
Brilliant.
So yeah, it was used as raw currency too.
Yeah. So what's extraordinary about this is the way that it started at all. Now, I've got some cocoa beans here. Now, if you've not seen a cocoa bean, it's about the size of the last joint of your finger, maybe a little bit smaller than that, last joint of your little finger. They have been fermented and dried, which sort of kills the bean. And it looks very much like an almond. Now, when you break, I don't know if you can hear this, I'll break it open. Oh, this one's quite hard to break open. There we go. Broke it open there. And inside, it kind of collapses into lots of little shards, like sawdust-sized shards. And these are called the nibs, aren't they?
Yeah, that's it.
If you smell them, it does smell sort of alcoholic. It's a really sort of strong, incredibly complex flavour. I wouldn't say it's necessarily nice, but it just smells unbelievably complex, as though there's just so much going on in there.
Mm.
Slightly like coffee in a sense of the complexity, but very different. Like sort of rotten, really deep rotten fruit. Now I'm going to have a little bite. Let's have a little try. Okay. So the weird thing you get, first of all, is this sort of sense of cold. It's cold when you bite them, and that's partly because of the fat content, I presume. The overwhelming sensation is of a revolting flavour. it's really bitter. You do get the complexity of chocolate, but the overwhelming sensation is the bitterness. And that's obviously the taste, not the smell. But the smell then starts to seep through your sinuses. And again, I wouldn't say it's lovely, but it's intoxicating in a way, because there's so much going on. There's so much depth. But so what I find extraordinary is bloke in jungle stumbles across cocoa pod, finds a way to ferment it and kill it, and then roast it. Then they taste it. It's flipping horrible. But they persevere with it, and it becomes a very, very special drink. Mm. Now, this is a story of human invention and perseverance, I would say, because the taste in my mouth is horrible. So it's come such a long way from stumbling across it to where we are today. And people have persevered, and there has been, there must have been some magical sensation. Do you think, Emma, that that complexity and the overwhelming, intoxicating flavour that people just became obsessed with?
Yeah, it must have just taken their breath away. I think, you know, that there isn't anything like it. So I don't know about the bean that you have there. Have you got a roasted bean there?
It's been roasted and fermented, yeah.
Right, okay, because, there's a big kind of difference there. But, sure. You know, cacao does contain things that release chemicals in your brain, serotonin, which can influence your brain cells, lighten your mood. It can increase sexual desire, appetite, memory. It can even aid sleep, even though there are tiny, tiny amounts of caffeine in it. Not a lot, really, actually. And it contains small levels of amphetamines, which will stimulate dopamine, you know, make you feel good. Yeah. Yeah. It has all that going on, you know, and the more raw it is, the more likely you're going to have those kind of effects. So
I'm flipping flying here, I tell you, I'm on one. and what's interesting is that there's a lot, you know, a lot of this is talked about, and a lot of people say, yeah, but it's tiny amounts and it's not going to do that much. Mm. But you've got to remember that if you feed chocolate to dogs, it's those neurotoxins that are dangerous. So that, you know, and they can be killed because they don't have the process to be able to deal with it like we do. But, you know, they are very powerful substances. You know, in modern, you know, in a bar of dairy milk, it's not, you won't necessarily get a massive hit of all those things, but they are there. Okay. So I think that's quite fascinating that there's a sort of medicinal side to it. Do you think it's a tangible impact that you get from chocolate these days? The functionality of it?
I think it depends on the chocolate, doesn't it? As you just said, like a dairy milk bar, even though it's going to give you that nice warm fuzzy feeling, perhaps it's not going to stimulate you in the same way, because, you know, when you process chocolate in that way, you lose all of those things. Like, there's very little caffeine left in a chocolate bar once you've processed it, you know. But if you're going to have that kind of nice dark high level of cacao in your chocolate, then you're going to get a very different hit from it. And I have to say, I've made chocolate from scratch many times. Mm. I have a Mexican metate, and I use that. So when I actually make that solid piece of, you know, chocolate cake, which you then grate from, and then I add that just to water, and then mix it, I find I have possibly the nicest hot chocolate that you can ever have. Far nicer.
That's extraordinary. So no milk, none of all that milk fat that we normally get in our dairy milk.
No. And it's actually, I find that, you know, perhaps you might want to add a little bit of vanilla or something, but that is enough. And I have a really sweet tooth. So that is such an incredible, rich, wonderful flavour when you make it yourself. It is like nothing you taste anywhere else.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so because we're talking about things like this, let's bring out the big A word, aphrodisiacs. Is there any such thing as an aphrodisiac?
There are things in cacao that can stimulate and kind of make all those reactions and create all those chemicals in your brain. Mm. And I think that is actually a real thing. But, you know, I do think that at its height of popularity in this country, sort of if you're looking at the 16 and 1700s, you know, and in Europe, especially in France, I mean, they were obsessed with it as, you know, as an aphrodisiac.
Yeah.
And what we've also got to remember is that very early Spanish communities, I hate the word Spanish, but before Spain, you know, pre-Hispanic communities and early Spanish communities were using it a lot to aid fertility. And they believed very strongly in it. And they also added things like menstrual blood to it to attract a member of the opposite sex and to help them have babies, basically, you know. And so I think those stories must have, you know, filtered down in, you know, throughout Europe. And then so it became this thing where, yeah, it will kind of increase your libido. It will make you more fertile. And, you know, we know that in Versailles, they used it. You know, a great deal. Madame Pompadour, Marie Antoinette, particularly Madame Pompadour, she was said to have a terrible libido. She really wasn't interested at all. And she used to have it in the morning with celery, which sounds a bit strange. You know, and they did it to sort of, you know,
Get going, get fruity.
Yeah, to get, you know, they were mistresses. They needed to do their job.
Perform.
Yes. Yeah. Dreadful. Yeah.
And I guess the whole concept of an aphrodisiac, it doesn't even have to be, you know, a chemical reaction. It's part of the magic, isn't it? If you say something's an aphrodisiac, then often people will believe it and therefore it will become that. So I did a survey at one point where I asked people, what was the last thing you ate before you had sex? You know,
and oh, really?
Rather than asking what do you find an aphrodisiac? And it was often things like a light meal or a special meal. Yeah. It was often actually things like a takeaway. it was a scene setter. My wife is a dark chocolate chick, but I'm a real cheap date. You know, I understand the flavors. I love the concept of dark chocolate, but you know what? I scoff dairy milk. I do. When did the sweetness become a massive part of this? And when did the full industrial chocolate really start to come in?
The thing is, I think what people don't realize is that even in the 1500s, 1600s, we were adding sugar, you know, very small amounts of sugar, but it was mixed with more spices. So you get your cinnamon and your nutmeg and your vanilla and your rose water and all kinds of things that they were adding with it to give it flavor. But yeah, sugar was added right from the start, because those early transcribed books that came from Spain across Europe during the 1600s, those recipes all contained small amounts of sugar. So you would grind it down at the time. But obviously it wasn't anything like the sort of sugar that we know in a chocolate bar now. And I guess really when we started to use sugar more was when we started to add it more as a foodstuff. Because for a long time, you've got to remember, chocolate was just a medicinal aid, you know, or something to pep you up in the morning. It wasn't something that you would ever conceive of putting in food. Yeah. You know, so, you know, during the 1700s, you see recipes creeping in, particularly the first thing they started to put it in was biscuits. And then from biscuits, you get it going into jellies and then slowly into cakes.
Chocolate jelly. I don't know why that sounds really odd and unpleasant, whereas it should sound really lovely, shouldn't it?
Well, to be honest, I think it was probably more about the fact that jellies a couple of hundred years ago were often made on the basis of being medicinal. So the medicinal aspect and the jelly was just like, well, let's combine the two. Yeah. And so people realize, oh, this is quite nice. Wonder what happens if we add this, you know, to a cake or something. So that's kind of how it sort of, you know, grew and grew.
Hi there. Only me. I just want to break into the conversation to say that if you're enjoying this episode, then once it's finished, you might want to check out another of our History Of podcasts. It's called The History of Tea and features Will Battle, author of the World Tea Encyclopedia. You can search for it now on our website at foodmatterslive.com. But now, back to the chat. Really sort of started to kick off in Britain with the Quakers, didn't it? Who really industrialised chocolate. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
With the Quakers, obviously, they were non-drinkers, so wanted to push chocolate as an alternative to alcohol. and all the big kind of chocolate makers at the time, Cadbury's and Rowntree's, they were all Quakers. They were kind of at the peak of the manufacturing of it all because they were trying to peddle it as this wonderful, safe alternative. And
the temperance tool.
Yes, you get the temperance movement. You then get all these cocoa rooms opening up across the country. What they did is set them up next to pubs.
Brilliant.
As a good alternative. So you get up in the morning rather than go to the pub to get through the day, which is what a lot of people did. You would go and have your hot chocolate. You were given tokens, and the tokens looked like coins so as not to embarrass people.
Yeah.
And you would go into these cocoa rooms and exchange your token for, a cup of chocolate. And it worked really, really well, actually, for quite a long time. And I think it did improve the problems we had with alcohol in this country, during the, 1800s, really, was at its peak.
And they really industrialised the process, didn't they? And even to the extent of the Cadbury's sort of built whole sort of mini towns, didn't they?
They were at the forefront of everything. And you've got to remember that they had patronage from the Queen as well. The first kind of gift boxes that went out during the Boer War, they were, made by Cadbury, but
yeah.
Valentine's Day, Cadbury's kind of marketed this heart-shaped box. Apparently, they didn't actually invent it, but they were the ones that marketed it, and it was a box that you could keep reusing.
Yeah.
And that's the first time during the Victorian period, really, where you get this sense of chocolates being given as gifts. And I really like the idea, actually, of thinking, well, that's always been the case, because those ancient communities, the Olmecs, the Mayans, the Aztecs, they were sacrificing and giving to the gods. Mm. And so you get that idea of gift giving all the time and getting, in return, they were getting the land to be fruitful. And I just love the fact it all sort of ties up, this chocolate as this wonderful gift that is given and received. And
but there's also, your book, it has the title The Dark History of Chocolate. So let's delve a little bit into the darker side of it. Why did you call it The Dark History?
There are many, many books about chocolate on the market. Most of them are, there are some wonderful books about chocolate on the market, but most of them are very fluffy. They look at all the wonderful aspects of chocolate. And really, chocolate has an incredibly exploitative legacy. I actually sometimes talk to people and they have no idea about that part of history. They know about empire and all the rest of it, but the fact that cacao and sugar in particular, all these things that we have today, those wonderful luxuries that we take for granted today, came from centuries of usurpation and spilling of blood and human life.
Yeah, a lot of these foods are really stained with tragedy, aren't they? So can you explain the connection between slavery and chocolate?
As soon as Europe learnt about cacao, this was the time of, great exploration and piracy, and, naval forces were just going into islands and countries and taking them over, taking everything they could and what they wanted when they wanted it. And, you get this great battle going on between, really early on is really the Spanish and the French and the Dutch, the English were a bit late. So they were all looking at ways in which they could take the cacao tree, because Spain had such a hold over South America. So the idea was to get us what they could, sneak it out, grow it in different regions. So, particularly the English, they took over, great parts of the West Indies. And Venezuela was a very early place that the English were in. And we basically started cultivating cacao, and in order to cultivate it, we needed a slave labor, and the majority of that was by exchanging things like ammunition and arms in Africa for people, and then shipping those people over to the West Indies and South America, and then exploiting millions and millions of people to work these plantations and keep us supplied in chocolate and sugar, basically. Yeah, that's how it worked.
Yeah, it It's a mucky, mucky history, isn't it? Of which just seems extraordinary today, and yet accusations of slavery in the cocoa industry persist, don't they? Can you tell us a little bit more about the modern day aspects of slavery?
Yeah, I mean, it's still going on. I think in 2002, nearly 300,000 children were working as slaves on cocoa farms located in Ghana, Nigeria, Cameroon, and the Ivory Coast. You know, and it's still going on, and the big names are still exploiting and, you know, clearing land, destroying the environment, you know. And it's not just the clearing of land either. It's the, you know, it's all the waste that then goes into the land and all the pollution. So you're then killing even more people in those areas, as well as exploiting them and taking lives in that way. You know, and it's just, unfortunately, there are some big companies, one in particular, that keeps getting fined, but then, you know, they get fined, but then carry on. And, you know, the great thing is that today, that the media are really onto it. You can't hide, they can't hide anymore. You know, that is one great thing about our modern media, is that a lot of these companies can no longer keep it a secret what they're doing. And there are changes happening. There are certain companies like Tony's are trying really hard to, you know, to create a chocolate which is completely slave-free by training farmers up, you know, and, you know, education is so key to these things. Yeah. But yes, it's still a disgusting trade in many ways.
And there's this massive paradox and disconnect between the fact that things like chocolate, coffee, the things that have the greatest value also have the greatest poverty aspects to it as well. And they are farmed by some of the poorest people in the world, which just does seem extraordinary. But let's get back to the history side of it and look at the development. Now, I'm interested in this sort of shift to the industrial side of chocolate. When did the first solid chocolate bar appear? Where did that really start happening?
It was the sort of early 1820s, and it was the Dutch, who were obviously heavily...
It's always the Dutch, isn't it? It's always the Dutch. Why can't we get things first? It's always the flipping Dutch.
but they were heavily involved in the trade as well. But they kind of invented a way to press the fat out of the cacao bean, and reduce the cocoa butter to, you know, almost half. And then they sort of created a cake. And then that could be ground down into cocoa powder. So first of all, you had your cocoa powder, but then they had this kind of way of putting back the cocoa butter and adding it with sugar and kind of mixing it all together, the cocoa butter, and using this clever hydraulic kind of press, you had a solid bar. Now, this was absolutely fantastic and obviously revolutionary, and it's what we have today. But they didn't keep their patent up. And Fry's was one of the first companies in this country to go, right, I'm having a bit of that. And they took the technology, and Fry's chocolate were the ones that developed the first bar over here in England.
And as you say, the science of chocolate is extraordinarily complex. I mean, my favourite chocolate book, obviously after yours, so everyone listening, you have to buy The Dark History of Chocolate by M.K. first. But secondly, you can get The Science of Chocolate, which is actually a Royal Society of Chemistry book. And it is dense and absolutely fascinating. And what is extraordinary is it's not just the chemistry of flavour. It's about the amazing physics and engineering that goes into particle grinding, tempering. The thing about putting milk into chocolate is that chocolate hates liquid. It hates water. So the water compound in milk, you know, it's immiscible. So you have to come up with all of these extraordinary processes to get every last bit of moisture out of milk before you introduce it. So it is, it's absolutely mind-blowing, baffling stuff. And this thing is full of graphs and biological diagrams. It really is. And that's one of the amazing amazing things, and which I find really inspiring about chocolate, is that it is a journey not just of history, but of engineering. And you know, you've got the Cadbury's and the Fry's coming up with new processes, and it's a huge trade. I mean, can you tell us about the importance of the chocolate trade?
It's become monstrously huge, hasn't it? I think they also play on our weaknesses for chocolate.
Yeah.
You know, there is always this, I mean, the way it's marketed is so clever. You know, I mentioned earlier about, you know, the heart-shaped boxes that Cadbury produced.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, playing up to every special occasion. You know, chocolate can be there for when you're down, when you're sad, when you, you know, need this, that, and the other. You know, for years, chocolate was seen as this thing, you know, if you were premenstrual or you're menopausal, you go for the chocolate. This massive kind of, it's a machine now, and there are so many different companies. But, you know, really, I think probably there's only about 4 or 5 big companies that probably actually own all the other smaller companies.
Yeah. Mondelez took over Cadbury's, for instance.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, and it is a mind-blowing thing, actually. And there are so many products on the market. I mean, you can get anything.
And it's inspirational. It's become a tool, isn't it? And I guess that's partly because of the chemistry of it. You know, it melts at body temperature. It's solid at room temperature. And so you can sculpt with it. You can do all sorts of things. So when was the golden age of chocolate creativity, do you think?
During wartime, it really suffered because we couldn't get access really to cacao or sugar.
Chocolate not high on the list during war compared to munitions.
Not really, but it was used as a morale boost. You get Queen Victoria sending out the chocolates during the Boer War. You then get during the First World War, Roundtree's did the tins and they sent all of those out. You then get this chocolates being developed over in America with Hershey's. They developed a specific bar of chocolate to keep the military sustained, but they didn't put enough sugar in it to make it addictive. They just kept it a very, you know, very high cocoa bar. Yeah. Over in America, you get the Prohibition, and then you get this obsession with chocolate during the Prohibition because they couldn't get alcohol. So that interwar period is really interesting because it's the real start of chocolate having a massive impact on the military, I think, really. And of course, you get Mars started up in the 30s as well, and they came and opened the big factory in Slough at that point. And then they start making things like, you know, the Milky Way. And, you know, that was as early as the 1930s. But so I think the Victorian period, the 1930s, and then again after the war, once they picked up, you get this big surge again in the 1960s.
And then you got all the sort of classics then unfold, things like the flake with its turgid, rather erotic approach to advertising. And all those products that sort of then unfold.
Turkish Delight, that was another one, wasn't it? That was really
yes, absolutely. Oh, what's happened to that?
Sensual, yeah. Wasn't it? Everything was. Yeah,
it was all about sex. Obsessed with sex, it was.
It is.
And I think that's what's interesting about your book is that you have all these incredible stories. You know, serial killers, you know, medicine, witchcraft. Mm. Can you tell us some of your favorite strange secret stories that we might not know about that are attached to chocolate?
The one that I find particularly odd, really, is Leonardo Cianciulli, the soap maker of Correggio. Mm. She had a soap making business in the 1930s in Italy, and she was obsessed with fortune tellers and travelling gypsies. And they all kept predicting to her that she'd lose all her children and she'd go to prison and she'd go mad. And
nice,
so she took,
you pay your money.
And she took this to heart, you see, and she started sacrificing people as a means to prevent it, I really don't understand that logic. But anyway,
a serial killer, you're not supposed to understand.
No, that's true. But anyway, and she, what she she started doing is she would invite women into her home for, you know, tea or whatever. And then she would kill them and cut them into little pieces. And then she would add those little pieces to both her soap and to chocolate cakes to give to the next lady that came, and so that they would kind of eat those. Wow. Yeah, that's just really, I mean, that's...
You've really gone dark with your research here, haven't you?
It's pure madness, pure madness. Yeah. So there are quite a few, I cannot emphasize enough that there are millions and millions of stories about chocolate and how it was used to as an aid to kill people, to poison people, because it's so thick,
yes,
and full of flavour that you can put just about anything into it and it will be odourless and tasteless. Arsenic was used all the time. Mm. And the Victorian period is full of stories of arsenic poisoning. But I mean, the one I do like, which is an upbeat one.
Oh, thanks.
Which is... I had to put a few upbeat ones in there.
Yeah, but then the clue is in the title, I suppose, isn't it? But go on.
Exactly. What do you
lift us from the mire.
What do you expect? But during the First World War, British soldiers found themselves fighting on the front line in a village in northwest France called Zaimes. And there are diaries from infantrymen at the time, and they describe this period of really intense shelling, and it made it impossible for anything to get through to the troops. And there was one man called Private Elmer Richards, and he was wounded really badly by shrapnel. But on learning the plight of his men, his company, he managed to get hold of a significant amount of chocolate, large quantities of chocolate, and he walked 2 miles to the shell fire in absolute agony to ensure that every single man received a portion of chocolate. He was awarded Distinguished Service Cross as well. So
that is absolutely fantastic. And again, sort of it talks to the concept of it being transformative. Now, just my very last question is, the problem with chocolate is that it's got to be grown in a relatively limited geographical zone, hasn't it, where it thrives, and that's often in Africa or South America. Is it possible to grow cocoa in the UK, and is there any point?
Do you know, I've asked myself that question before. I think in the right controlled environment, you can probably grow anything. But to be honest, I think everything is going to become genetically modified soon anyway. Mm. And I think that will be one way of, I'm not saying that's a good thing, but I think it will be one way of dealing with issues of the environment and of slavery and, you know, all those terrible things that are associated with the trade. And I really think that's the way it's going. I think some of the major companies are already experimenting with that. And that's probably what we'll see.
That's extraordinary. So good thing or a bad thing, or just a development?
From my point of view, I don't like that idea. I would like to sample some, I suppose, and then make my mind up. Yeah.
Taste it, then believe. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Well, Emma, thank you so much for your time. Emma Kay, and her absolutely brilliant book, The Dark History of Chocolate. Run out and buy it. So thank you very much, Emma.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Stefan.
Thank you. Now, I hope you enjoyed that episode of the Table Talk podcast. We've got hundreds more at foodmatterslive.com. Try searching on the site for an episode we recently did called HFSS, How Brands Can Still Make an Impact. It's all about new restrictions on the promotion of foods that are high in fat, salt, and sugar, like chocolate. And it includes some fascinating insights. Follow to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And thank you so much for listening in.